The island was shattered in violent catastrophes that were accompanied by fire, and in these upheavals, the cultural and political ages of the Minoan kingdom went down, at the same time that corresponding Egyptian ages were terminated. Troy III was destroyed, and its 50-feet-thick fortress wall fell when the Middle Kingdom in Egypt fell. The volcano on the island of Tara exploded with almost unimaginable fury. Recent archaeological work in the Indus Valley showed, too, that about 1500, and in advance of the Aryan invasion, cities with great walls were destroyed and a flourishing civilization came to a sudden end. The synchronization of the Exodus with the end of the Middle Kingdom was also the starting point of a reconstruction of ancient history from that point on to the advent of Alexander the Great, which took the form of a two-volume work, Ages in Chaos, the first volume of which was published in the spring of 1952, and which coordinates recent archaeological finds telling the story of the Exodus and the physical happenings in Egypt from the Egyptian side. The problem of the time of the Exodus in Egyptian history has never been solved. Of course, the pyramid gives a date, and the time solution keeps getting closer to it. The problem of the time of the Exodus in Egyptian history, which the pyramid gives as 1453 B.C., had never been solved. In the papyrus Ethuwera and the Naos of El Arish, two archaeological finds, I found descriptions of a natural upheaval very similar, sometimes identical with the description in the book of Exodus. These are heathen records archaeological digs have uncovered in Egypt. Their descriptions are as follows. Following plagues when the river was blood-colored, amid a hurricane and darkness of 7 days' duration, the Pharaoh and his host were drowned in a whirlpool at Pihath-Keroth, the same place where the Pharaoh of the Exodus was drowned. These parallels compel me to fix an unorthodox date for the Exodus, because he was competing with the tradition that the Exodus took place in the 12th century, based upon some very faulty genealogical records that never made any distinction between a son and a grandson. So under the enslavement of Bishop Usher and his followers, who dated the earth and its happenings by genealogies, and as I said, when we looked at Genesis 9, 10, 11, if you read from the Septuagint, the one that Jesus quoted and Paul quoted, which doesn't really make it absolutely authoritative on those things, they add 100 years to each of those people's, the patriarchs' lives. Genealogies give hints. They're not absolute dating methods. And using genealogies, the world had settled on the 12th century as the date of the Exodus. The pyramid said 1453, the 15th century. These works by Velikovsky pushed it to within 7 years of 1453. Velikovsky's coordinates are 7 years off from the pyramid, using archaeology and various other events, which are much more, I mean, a seven-year deviation when you're back at 1400, 15th century B.C. These parallels compel me to fix an unorthodox date for the Exodus. Collating the historical texts of following generations for 1,200 years, I could establish numerous correlations between the histories of Egypt and of Israel which could not be accidental. My reconstruction demonstrated that Egyptian histories and the histories of the nations which are written in harmony with it are out of line with the historical past by about 600 to 700 years. And this is the book where he does most of that, Ages in Chaos. His vast collating showed most traditional history to be off by 600-700 years. That's why I told you the other night, a 500-year spread means nothing when you're back that far. It's too hot in here. Thus, both my works have their starting point in the recognition that the Middle Kingdom in Egypt went down in a great natural catastrophe. The recent excavation in Jericho has confirmed the fact that the great walls of the city fell a few decades after the end of the Middle Kingdom, but at the time in which conventional chronology places the arrival of the Israelites under Joshua in Canaan, there was no city at Jericho and no walls to fall. According to Ages and Chaos, however, the Israelites came to the walls of Jericho one generation after the end of the Middle Kingdom. And the enigmatic hiatus of 600 years proves not to be real. I expect new evidence from the Minoan scripts and the so-called Hittite pictographs. Texts in the Minoan, Linear B, script were found years ago on Crete and in Mycenae and in several other places on the Greek mainland. I believe that when the Minoan writings unearthed in Mycenae are deciphered, they will be found to be in Greek. I also claim that these texts, and he was proved right, by the way, I also claim that these texts are of a later date than generally believed. No dark age of 6 centuries duration intervened in Greece between the Mycenaean Age and the Ionian Age of the 7th century. Before long, he says, new evidence will come from the so-called Hittite pictographic writings found in Asia Minor. Hittite civilization, they didn't even know it existed until a relatively recent archaeological find. Before long, new evidence will come from the so-called Hittite pictographic writings found in Asia Minor, Mesopotamia, and northern Syria. Since the recent discovery of Kara Tepe in Asia Minor of bilingual inscriptions in ancient Hebrew and in pictographs, efforts at decipherment have entered a new stage. Today, the Hittite pictographs are already in the process of being read. In my reconstruction, I come to the conclusion that they are Chaldean signs. Not Hittite. Now, you need to follow Abram and all of his power under Terah when they settle in Haran. Haran was dead before they got there. The most logical explanation for the name of Haran is they named it for his brother. These were powerful people. Terah had been a ruler in Nimrod and Samiris's great city. They were kings. Look at the power of Laban when Jacob went back to find a wife. And when Abram sent his servant to find a wife for there's every reason to believe that these powerful brothers of Abraham, as Abram came down, pay tithe to the king of Canaan, Shem, who had done his work of cleanup in Egypt and went back and built Jerusalem. And as is too often cloaked in the Sunday school studies of Genesis, Jacob came down to Egypt as the respected king of Canaan and blessed the Pharaoh. He hadn't had power and substance to presume such an action with the Pharaoh would have brought death. And when he died, all the rulers of Egypt went back to his funeral until they named the city where he was buried the grief of the Egyptians. There's every reason to believe that Abram's powerful brothers moved off across the Anatolian plateau, but that's another subject as we pursue the Hittites. Their pictographic writings are Chaldean, Velikovsky concludes, not Hittite. I also expect unequivocal evidence that these signs were used down to the last century before the present era. Not boring you? There's only one thought to what Velikovsky is saying, that coordinated with certain biblical records of catastrophe, those unwilling to accept the mindset laid down in the first decades of the 1800s, will find that archaeology and history and literature confirm a consistent series of catastrophes striking this earth. Now, the biblical view of man is he was great and became not much, and we've been building it back. The scientific view and the traditional view is that man came out of a cave, grabbed some woman with her hair, and started a family. Ate bugs until he learned to use a club. And man has progressively gotten better. That whole view is the antithesis of the biblical view. Now, I went through a loss of faith in university by people passing on these regurgitated ideas that they got out of their textbook thoughtlessly and mindlessly. And I'm on a crusade, not necessarily to convince people of the biblical view, but at least to make the point it's not ridiculous. Sure not as ridiculous as these television evangelists make it. The Bible's view is man started high and got very low and has been climbing back and can't climb back without the help of God. The worldview is man started low and has been getting better ever since. And what do the facts of history suggest when you take the mindset away and do what Velikovsky did? You find the biblical record is a more accurate generic concept. The biblical view of the history of this earth is repeated cataclysms. Satan in Eden sometime before Genesis 1-2 ever begins. In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and the literal Hebrew reads, and the earth became a waste and a desolation. And what you read in Genesis 1-2 onward is recreation. Else why did God say to him, replenish the earth, instead of plenish it? Jeremiah saw the earth before there was any man. And yet there were cities. That's the King James. The Hebrew is a year meeting places of intelligent beings. Then he sees a great cataclysm strike the earth. Mountains move. Then uses the exact same Hebrew phrase. The earth became a waste and a desolation. The Bible teaches a cataclysm of destruction because of man's evil that we identify with the flood, biblically. The Bible teaches great upheavals that accompanied the deliverance of his people out of Egypt. Velikovsky is showing that the records on all fronts support the periodic cataclysmic view of this earth's development. Not the uniform, everything as it is, mountains become plains at the same rate, seas lay down sediment at the same rate, glaciers move at the same rate. That's what this is about. And I'm leading up to something else. W.F. Libby and his associates at the University of Chicago have developed the radiocarbon method of dating organic matter. Wood from under the foundation of the Hittite fortress of Alazar in Asia Minor turned out to be 700 to 800 years younger than conventional chronology would allow, thus giving full support to my dating. Hittite history, interwoven with Egyptian history of the New Kingdom, cannot be shortened without at the same time shortening the history of Egypt. If carbon 14 dating of the Hittite kingdom shortens its history by 600 to 700 years, we have absolute archaeological and historical date of the great war between the Hittites and Egypt now uncovered, a war that for years archaeologists didn't even know happened, much less historians. And if that war occurred between a pharaoh and a king of the Hittites, and Hittite history is shortened 700 years, then we got to shorten Egyptian history. Otherwise, the king that's fighting the Hittite king came to the battle 700 years before the Hittite king got there. That's what he's saying. The age of pieces of wood from the tombs of the Old and Middle Kingdoms in Egypt also proved to be in harmony with my reconstruction. However, for the decisive period, that of the New Kingdom, no radiocarbon analysis has been made. I suggest that some objects in the possession of museums, he was given this speech in the 50s, dating from the New Kingdom in Egypt, the dynasty of Hatshepsut, Thutmose III, Akhenaten, and King Tut himself, and those of Ramses II and Ramses III, be subjected to the radiocarbon tests. In recent years, Russian archaeologists have discovered abundant remains of human culture in northeastern Siberia, in the frozen taiga where frozen bodies of mammoths are found and where nobody suspected human abodes in ages past. There was human population in northeastern Siberia in Paleolithic time, in Neolithic time, and in the Bronze time too. Paleolithic artifacts were found in Yakutia, rock drawings very similar to the Paleolithic drawings on the rocks and in the caverns of France and Spain were found in the Valley of Lena near the village Shishkino. And, quote, in the Neolithic age, about 2 to 3 millennia before our era, Neolithic races, descendants of earlier inhabitants of Yakutia, spread to the very coast of the Arctic Ocean in the north and the Kolyma in the east. I can go on for another 2 or 3 hours. What is this saying? The evidence is there for abundant catastrophes. He's concentrating on the Middle Kingdom. Now let's go back to the flood. Isaac Vail and others pioneered the canopy theory that I referenced the other night. Once before, I quickly looked at this book. If you have any interest in pursuing the idea that prior to the flood it was a different kind of world with a canopy that affected the climate, gave substance to the biblical claim that there was no rain on the earth, things were watered with a mist, and that could explain a subtropical climate around the world, you need to read this book by Joseph C. Dillow. Probably the most thorough, heavy, detailed study of the various canopy theories ever put in print. Joseph C. Dillow, The Waters Above. Now we're going to join some more cities. So let me pause for about 7 seconds. Joseph C. Dillow, The Waters Above, is the most exhaustive study of the canopy theories in print. If I were trying to read this to you, it would make Velikovsky sound like a kindergarten bedtime story. The canopy theory postulates a primeval body of water surrounding the earth above its atmosphere. It has been discussed by many writers and speakers throughout the past century, identified with the waters which were above the firmament. This writer says, I first learned of the canopy theory in 1941 in a lecture with Dr. Irwin Moon in one of his famous Moody Bible Institute sermons from science. Isaac Vail over here in Pasadena probably carried it the furthest. Now, if you want to really study it, this is the book. I'm not going to read it to you. I want to just skip along and show you some things, okay? Stand by, Mike. Now, if I'd read all that to you, you'd really be confused. Finally, to chapter 2. Then God said, let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters. And God made the expanse and separated the waters which were below the expanse from the waters which were above the expanse, and it was so. And God called the expanse heaven. And there was evening and there was morning, a second day. That's Genesis 1, 6 and 7, but doesn't sound like the good old Holy King James. Give me that bottom Bible there. How in the world did you bring all my books and put the Bible on the bottom? Just throw the camera down. It only costs $40,000. That didn't sound like King James, did it? Let's try a good old King James. King James good enough for Paul. King James good enough for Adam. And God said, let there be a firmament. How many of you have got that in your King James? And God said, let there be a firmament. I remember when I was in Bible school, before I went to college, some guy getting up in the chapel in the morning and sending us all to hell because we'd gone modern and said the Holy Spirit when the Bible obviously said Holy Ghost. Of course, the Greek word was pneuma. Here we go again. The Bible clearly says, let there be a firmament. What is this business of an expanse? Let there be an expanse. Let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters. And let it, the firmament, divide the waters from the waters. How many of you have a little number by the word firmament? And you go to the middle column, the reference column, and you find that number. And the number is 3. And you look at 3 and it says the Hebrew word is expansion. Is that what your Bible says?
Yes, sir.
Well, I'll be. Let there be an expanse. Firmament's an expansion. In the midst of the waters. And let it, the expansion, separate the waters which were under the firmament expanse, which were under the expanse from the waters which were above the expanse. And it was so. So if even the good old King James, we translate the word expanse, when God was doing this recreative work, the Spirit of God moved. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Nobody knows when that was. I don't have any trouble with. Maybe, you know, maybe God decided Let's do it in such a way that it'll create a lot of mystery. Let's layer a layer of worms down, a layer of shells down, a layer of frogs down, a layer of... He could have done it that way if he's the creator. Be thou a rock layer with shells in it. Then we can sit up there in heaven while we wait for these nuts to learn to trust us and be entertained by their digs. Or a God to whom a day is a thousand years, in whom there is no time. He could have decided to let it evolve. All it says is, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth. Now the heaven is an expanse. He can put what he wants in the expanse. There was a lot of expanse above the earth and its waters when the happening of Genesis 1-2 occurred, and the earth was without form and void. The literal is, the earth became a waste and a desolation. Now, sometime between Genesis 1-1 and Genesis 1-2, Satan was in Eden when he was the crowning cherub of the mountain of God, before he fell. And at least one great cataclysm occurred when Jesus beheld Satan cast out of heaven, and that's not the one that Michael will do again. Because the earth becomes a waste and a desolation, and then we encounter Satan in the form of the serpent in his evil role. Now, there are pictures in Isaiah of his prideful act in Eden when he became lifted up in pride for his beauty, when the prophet looked through Tyre to the real ruler, which was the dragon, and spoke of his earlier estate. Genesis 1-2 onward is a recreated period. And darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. Now comes light. And then sixth verse, God said, let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, let it divide. Just slice through the waters, and some above and some below. Then he called that expanse heaven. Well, there's another expanse on the other side of the waters. It's heaven out there. Then very precisely he says, let the waters under the heaven, which is the new name for the expanse, be gathered together in one place, so dry land will appear. That probably involved a cataclysm, a buckling of land under the water, and a forming of mountains so that waters gathered in one place. Land in another place. Now, did one place mean one place? It did. There was only one great ocean. And was Atlantis in the middle of that ocean? And was the catastrophe that struck Atlantis, if it existed, an earlier catastrophe? Or was it the same catastrophe that produced the flood? Good questions, huh? Genesis 7. Verses 11 to 12, in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on the same day, all the fountains of the great deep burst open, the floodgates of the sky were opened, and the rain fell upon the earth for 40 days and 40 nights. Floodgates of the skies opened, and the fountains of the great deep burst open. That's why they didn't rain for 40 days, they're going to flood the earth. But if there was a canopy that enabled the floodgates of the sky, the water that had been separated with a firmament or expanse between, opened, there was not only a gushing up, but more. There'd never been any rain. And if there was a canopy of water surrounding this earth, or a form of water that could gush as the fountains of the deep, or a form of substance that could become water and gush down as fountains, I can understand the flood caused by that. Where do we get the word firmament? From Jerome's Latin Vulgate, implying something firm that came from the medieval concept of the celestial vault of ancient mythology. The King James that drew more, it's too cold now, the King James that drew more upon the Vulgate than it did original documents. Just pass firmament right on into the King James, which means a firm, solid substance. That'd knock your head if you took off in a rocket, wouldn't it? Now, I'm going to skip over all of the proofs that he gives from ancient mythology of every culture recognizing, in some of its generic, to borrow from Velikovsky, cultural memory, a celestial cosmology postulated a vault, or not a vault, but a canopy of the heavens that's separated by an expanse and then the earth. But let's assume this existence for a moment, because this book, if you want to get all the details, just read it. I think we should get it, put it in our bookstore, and have plenty of copies. What would happen if there was a canopy? Well, it explains the idea that is prevalent in all cultures that heaven's north, because the opening of the canopy was up where the spin of the poles opened up into the blue sky. Just about every ancient legend speaks of the birth of the sun or the birth of a new sun. Well, if you saw the sun through a canopy, and only the brightest stars through the canopy, like swimming in the bottom of a pool, you look at the sky, it has a different look. Then when the canopy's gone, those who existed before the canopy, if the family of Noah, the Antediluvians, represent that, too cold, turned off completely. Then suddenly, after the canopy's gone, you'll see new stars, and the sun will have won the victory and the battle over that that hid it. And suddenly it bursts on the scene in ancient cultures with a new prominence that brought forth the worship of the sun and new stars. There was no rainfall if there was a canopy. The earth was covered with that which gave it a greenhouse effect. That'll explain palm trees in Greenland. That'll explain mammoths in Siberia. He really gets scientific. I mean, this guy, look at some of the formulas he lays down. as he's discussing the making of rain, the total heat necessary to vaporize a given amount of water. And this is no dummy book. Now, he goes through a whole chapter on the scriptural evidence for a canopy. The mist that used to rise from the earth. No rainbows prior to the flood. No seasons prior to the flood. Seasons are mentioned for the first time as markers of climate changes in Genesis 8:22. There weren't any seasons before the flood. Now, because this guy's a fundamentalist, he has to make the case for Noah getting drunk. And he points out, he's got an equation for it. The conversion of glucose to alcohol and carbon dioxide gas. The reaction can only proceed as the CO2 is allowed to escape, and a higher atmospheric pressure will result in a higher partial pressure of CO2, which in turn will retard the escape of CO2. In the ancient world, it would have taken longer under the canopy for the wine to be produced under the condition of a doubled partial pressure of CO2. Once the canopy had condensed, the rate of formation of the alcohol in the wine would be speeded up, and Noah was simply caught off guard. There was more alcohol in that wine than there would have been in grapes fermenting for the same length of time under the water heaven. He's probably right. The TV evangelist in the hotel and motel in Florida wouldn't have had a prayer if there was a canopy. That's it. His defense before. The religious mafioso should be, there was no canopy. Hello, Rattler Teeth. I boring you? Now, you got here an hour before I got here. You going to stay with me?
Yes, sir.
Then he comes to ancient longevity. Now, after the canopy, clouds, wind currents, condensation, vaporization, rain, and the cycle, it's possible. It wasn't possible when the canopy was there. Chapter 4, he covers the canopy in world mythology. You'll find it in every country. Babylon, Samaria, ancient Sumer, Egypt, Greece, too hot now. The Polynesians, the Persians. And I won't, boy, it'd be interesting to read some of those myths to you. I might come back at a later time and do it, but I'm heading for a gestalt tonight that I want you to see. Also points out that the very dependable carbon 14 dating method is blown apart before the flood. So all these dates that carbon-14 uses, the whole system is blown apart if there was a canopy before the flood. Because the chemical process that produces carbon-14, he spends a whole chapter on that, is blown apart if the canopy's there. The Earth is constantly being bombarded with radiation from the sun and from deep space. Thanks to the shielding effect of our present atmosphere, biology on this planet is effectively protected from the lethal effects of this cosmic assault. However, with a canopy surrounding the Earth, an even greater degree of protection would have been afforded, and one might predict a reduced radiation level. This is thought to have a possible connection with longevity of life and carbon-14 production. Nearly 75 years ago, Isaac Vail proposed that the shielding effect of the water heaven reduced radiation levels, and as a result, the pre-flood conditions simply impelled long life. More recently, V.L. Westberg argued that the life shortening of the post-flood patriarchs was caused by accumulated exposure from space radiation that had not been present prior to the flood. He then gives a table of the patriarchs from Noah on. Noah, age of death, 950. Shem, 600. Arpachshad, 438. Shelah, 433, Eber, 464, Peleg, 239, on down to Abraham, 175, Terah's father, 205, Isaac, 180, Jacob, 147, Moses, 120, but he states that 70 is the norm. Now we're starting to extend it back again as we gain some scientific knowledge to protect. He even works out formulas. A linear regression yield. He tables it. The number of generations from Noah. And he works out a curve for it. I mean, this guy really, he's no dummy. He discusses the electromagnetic spectrum. Cosmic rays, gamma rays, X-rays, extreme UV, 4UV, middle UV, near UV, visible infrared. Radiation exposures in the United States. And I'm telling you, he ends up convincing me that we would all be better off if we had a canopy. Yeah. If I could carry a canopy around with me and it'd... The canopy and carbon-14 production. Assuming the existence of a water vapor canopy, we would have to predict that the amount of C-14 at the surface of the earth before the flood would be much less than it is today. As a consequence, dating calculations based on this method for pre-flood dates would be much too high and give dates much older than actual. Now, the Bible's been torn apart with the dates of the antediluvian period being destroyed by extensions of carbon-14 dating. But that's based upon what Velikovsky is setting out to shatter, and others are starting to shatter, that the Earth has always been as it now is. If this great catastrophe that we call the flood was a worldwide catastrophe with resulting in the removal of a canopy, then carbon-14 datings go into a hazy period when they go into the period under the canopy. Because the accumulation of C-14 or carbon-14 would be much less. And having never lived under the canopy, we don't really know how to project the ratio of carbon-14 accumulation under the canopy. Am I boring you? I mean, we're already 175 pages. I spent 6 months to go 175 pages in the past. I remember spending a month on one paragraph in Holy Blood, Holy Grail. Give me a little credit. The radiocarbon dates depend on the ratio of radiocarbon, C14, to normal carbon, C12, in the organic fossil remains of a plant or animal. Carbon-14 is a radioactive isotope of regular carbon and is formed when atmospheric nitrogen, N14, is bombarded by cosmic radiation. So there is a certain amount of this material in the atmosphere at all times. As a result, all living systems ingest radiocarbon into their cellular material. As soon as they die, however, they immediately begin to stop ingesting C14 from the atmosphere, and the C14 already in their system begins to decay. Half of the original amount of C14 in the biological system will decay every 5,770 years. This number is called the half-life of C14. Now, when you're dealing in 5,770-year increments with the half-life remaining, each time it's cut in half every 5,770 years, and you find a piece of fossilized material or material that has an organic base that enables it to ingest this carbon, you can then date back. The further back you get, I mean, you have more fun with radiocarbon when you go way back where you're in the 10,000 B.C., 20,000 B.C. But if there was a canopy, all bets are out in the first half-life. So it becomes a very unreliable instrument of scientific precision in dating. Yet, we poor dummies, unsophisticated with such fancy numbers, somebody comes along and says, carbon-14 dating says he's 10,822 days old and 10,222 years old and 14 days and 17 hours and 6 minutes. I ain't going to argue with you. Turn the cooler on. But when it is understood, and we're assuming it, I ain't arguing for this. I'm just saying, let's open our mind. Before we throw the Bible out, you don't have to park your brain to be a Christian. And since the 1800s opened up, we've been sold a bill of goods that everything acts the way it is. I got an undergraduate major in geology. I know all about these paleontological periods. And I don't think Bishop Usher correctly dated the creation of the earth. Now, to those who just joined us, I have a very interesting subject, a canopy. Joseph Dillo, The Waters Above, is maybe the most exhaustive study of the theory that before the flood there was a vast canopy that covered the earth. And the waters poured out of it, and that caused the flood. I thought it was bad being in there with the animals. It's like the old saying, if you feel bad because you got a limp, find a man with one leg. I always felt bad in there in the ark with those animals. With this canopy emptying out, I have a new view of it. If there was a canopy, I'm over to 175 in this book, the dating of carbon-14 methodology is out the window in all pre-flood dates, because the canopy made the accumulation of radiocarbon at a much slower rate because these atmospheric bombardments were shielded. And the ingestion of the carbon that is necessary for this dating diminished. Carbon-12, or normal carbon, does not decay. Only the carbon-14, the radioactive isotope of regular carbon formed when atmospheric nitrogen is bombarded by cosmic radiation that would have been walled away by the canopy. Carbon-12, or normal carbon, does not decay, since all living organisms take in C-12 and C-14 as found in the atmosphere as long as the biological system is alive. The ratio of C14-C12 will remain the same in the biological system as it is in the air. But if the tissue dies and the equilibrium exchange between it and the environment ceases, then the amount of C14 in the tissue will begin to dwindle by decay because it's no longer being replaced by stocks from the surrounding atmosphere. So if a particular sample has lost exactly half of its original C14 content, then it is known that it is 5,770 years old. That's the way the system works. Now, this obviously assumes that the original amount of C14 in the biological system is known. This original amount determination is based on the assumption that the C14-C12 ratio in the environment at the time of death equals that ratio today. Problems arise in knowing the original ratio. If the amount of radiocarbon in the Earth's atmosphere at the time of the death of an animal was much less than the amount of radiocarbon today, it will appear that much more of the radiocarbon has decayed and hence that the animal is older than it really is. If the Earth was surrounded at one time by a water canopy, virtually no carbon-14 would be formed. So the lack of it, on the assumption that the Earth has always been the same, would cause the conclusion that the lack of it is because it has decayed. And if you're down to a 10% remainder in relationship to C12, then you got a 50,000-year lifespan projected, when in fact that animal may have lived under a canopy where no carbon-14 was being formed. He started out with a diminished ratio. Huh? You follow that? You see Jimmy preaching on this in Long Beach Arena? There is some evidence that the Earth was at one time without radioactive carbon. Harold Armstrong observes, first of all, there appears to be practically no radioactive carbon in coal. So if we accept that much of the coal comes from vegetation which was buried at the time of the flood, and that the time back to the flood is not much more than the half-life of radioactive carbon, which, for the present purposes, around figure of 5,500 years will do, it will follow there was practically no radioactive carbon in the atmosphere before the flood. Samples that were buried quite deeply, like coal, would characteristically be free from radioactive carbon. Flood deposits closer to the top could be easily contaminated, picking up a small amount of radiocarbon from the surroundings, so the indicated ages would be varied. Samples of such dating, if the original amount of C14 in the atmosphere was only 2.5% of today's values, and you assume everything's always been the same, then the time necessary for C14 in the sample to decay to the 10% level is 29,749 years. So the sample is dated as if it started out with 100% of today's level, but it actually had only 2.5% of today's level, therefore leaving out the calculation of 29,749 years. It will appear to be 29,749 years too old. A sample that was under the canopy dated as being 35,000 years old, may in fact be only 5,251 years old. I think that's significant. He just beats this subject to death. Now, look at his formulas. This guy's no dummy. Here he says, assuming this present-day ratio of RD, RP is correct, then the time which the buildup of radiocarbon began can be computed from RD over RP equals 1 minus E, 0693T over 5730. You got that? We can leave it then. He even discusses the canopy and rickets in ancient men. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
I'm getting some more exciting stuff. Goes through fossils, volcanic ash mixed with glacial ice, sudden and permanent temperature drop in polar regions, and why? Fewer meteorites in older strata who would hit the canopy first. Residual amounts in the stratosphere today. Then he critiques the various canopy models. Different theories of those who unite in believing there was a canopy, but explain it different ways. Long section on the liquid canopy, long section on the ice canopy model. Mechanical energy elements for the ice canopy to turn into fountains flowing from the heaven. Take a look at this page if you want to have some go to sleep with reading. And he takes the equations and shows how this ice shell could turn to a fountain of water, if that theory is adopted, through 2.5 pages. Mechanics of ice entry into the Earth's atmosphere. Plots some of those things like the return of a satellite. Page after page of equations. Spherical radius at which all the ice will melt is calculated on this table. The coefficient of drag. Radius ratios for ice entering from Roche's limit. Now, the gestalt of what I'm doing is to show that this is not a far-out idea for just nuts. Then it goes to the cloud canopy theory. Pages on that. Then he comes to what is his theory, the water vapor canopy model. But he gives fair coverage to each of them. Then, chapter 7, what the pre-flood atmosphere was like under such a canopy. How much is this book? Is it still available? I'd offer it tonight to those who want to buy it if I had a price, but I don't know what the price is, so I can't offer it. We'll have it in the bookstore, and maybe later I can tell you. Here, the vertical coordinate system for vapor canopy computer model. Volume fractions for each layer of the canopy atmosphere. Here's a real simple little formula he has worked out, an equation. Spectral intervals and transmission functions for each absorbing gas. Wavelengths in microns. Transmission function, HTO, H2O, CO2, and O2. Cloud albedo, spectral interval, random model band parameters in the infrared region for the transmission function, TRI. Carbon dioxide transmission function. Even discusses these ancient animals and the skeletons of the giant pterodactyl and the wind velocity, since some of these couldn't run, the wind velocity it would take in breezes for them to be airborne, and how the difference of the canopy creates the atmospheric condition enabling the flight to be possible. And then he comes to those particular animals that absorb from the atmosphere. And he has a whole chapter on how the canopy conditions were conducive to giant animals. That even if Noah put a couple of dinosaur babies in the ark, they wouldn't have survived the changed condition. I mean, there's no peanut little study. Here he is on the temperature inversions and the wind systems that would be affected, the stability of the pre-flood atmosphere. Getting bored? I am. I mean, I've read this whole dang thing this afternoon. The total heat load of the canopy. Possible means of reducing the heat load. Oxygen toxicity and nitrogen narcosis. Climate under the canopy. The dynamics of the canopy. Infrared cooling. Visibility through the canopy. Relative intensity of visible stars until he's able to work out a pretty good analysis of the stars of the heavens that could be seen through the canopy and the appearance of the sun, visibility in the pre-flood heavens, angles above the horizon, astrology, sun worship, and collapse of the canopy. Various legends, the riddle of frozen giants, the worldwide mammoth cemeteries. Board? The mammoth in Europe, the mammoth in North America, the number of frozen remains, over 50,000 carcasses in one place, the climate of Siberia and Alaska during the mammoth age. The mammoth's adaptation to cold, that's one of the great mysteries, these mammoths that were killed all at once in what are now cold climates that they couldn't exist in. Extermination of burial in mud flows, evidence of a continental flood, suffocated animals, upright carcasses, immense mammal caches, marine shells mixed with mammoth bones, caves and fissures in Europe, identification of stomach contents of some of these mammals that were killed suddenly in a catastrophe. I mean, there's no, you didn't just say what some say, some leaves are found in their belly. I mean, he's analyzing it. Trees, shrubs, herbs, grasses, mosses. Yeah. Now, the gestalt of what I want to do is not read this book to you, but show the depth of research that's gone into this. State of preservation of some of the stomach contents, the progressive decay of gladiolus flower petals in a solution of stomach juice at various temperatures in hours. Plot of dimensionless excess temperature versus the Fourier number fold for various values of the coordinates for a cylinder. I'm just going to leave that one and go right on by. Time in hours to bring the temperature of the stomach contents down to 40 degrees Fahrenheit. You know, if this sudden worldwide catastrophe that turned this greenhouse into a cataclysm, comparison of cooling and freezing rates in a cow and a mammoth. Comparison of cooling and freezing of a mammoth blast frozen and a mammoth buried in ice. A catastrophic freeze. on the thing. And then I'll get to the point. One of the marvels of natural history is the gigantic flying reptile called the pteranodon, whose remains are found in Cretaceous sediments. The wingspan of these flying reptiles has been estimated to be 6.95 meters. Table 5 gives the principal perimeters of the pteranodon. Memorize it quickly. Many authors have expressed wonder at how the animal could have flown. Belair states, pteranodon had the greatest difficulty in taking off from flat surfaces. While Romer comments, how this animal could get itself into the air from level ground is difficult to understand. The minimum flying speed necessary for these animals to sustain flight is easily calculated from standard formulas. L equals CL parenthesis 1/2, comma PV2S. D equals CD parenthesis 1/2, comma PV2S. I understand. Standard formulas were S, the wing area, P, the density of the air, 0.0013 gm/cm3 ; V squared, equal the flying speed, and CL equal the lift coefficient, and CD equal the drag coefficient, which is a complicated way of saying it's figured out. In order for the animal to sustain flight, the lift force L must be equal to or greater than the weight of the animal. This means, to skip over his formulas, that in order for the pteranodon to fly, a wind of 16.4 miles per hour must sweep across its wings, because it could not run at all. So to get airborne, it had to have a wind of 16.4 miles per hour. Who cares, you say? I don't really give a... I mean, you know, I have about as much interest in the pteranodon as I do, maybe a little more than I do Jimmy the Jerk. He can't fly either. Now, a wind velocity of 16.4 miles per hour is rated a moderate breeze by meteorologists. It seems that this raises some problems for flight. The pteranodon apparently had to wait a moderate breeze before it could take off from a standing position. But this clumsy arrangement would be somewhat lessened if the air density was greater. Under canopy conditions, flight would have been more easily achieved for these flying reptiles with the greater atmospheric pressure created by the vapor canopy. There are some experiments off the Florida coast of people testing healing qualities under great pressure. Any of you know about those experiments? Where cuts heal amazingly. They put people in that pressure chamber with a stroke. They had to carry them in. They walk out. Under the canopy, there were some healing qualities because of the oxygen change. Wow. You're getting bored. Of greater interest, however, is the recent discovery of a pterosaur, a variation of the pteranodon in some non-marine rock in West Texas. Its location in non-marine rock is significant because that indicates it was not located near water surfaces. It had been thought that those animals fed largely on fish and were able to soar due to the thermal updrafts and turbulent updrafts created by water temperature and wave motion. Furthermore, the topography in West Texas is flat, and hence the updrafts for soaring created by hills and cliffs were not as prevalent. Under those circumstances, the pterosaur would have been largely dependent on wind velocity to sustain flight at all. Most amazing was the apparent length of the wingspan. There's your pteranodon. Showed you that earlier. Here in ancient Artes pictured flying over the sea because they recognized the difficulty of flying without all those wind currents. Feet is the wingspan. From this, we can make some relatively accurate estimates of its wing area and mass. It goes through the equations and says a 25 mile per hour wind would be necessary for this pterosaur to get airborne. But under the increased atmospheric pressure of the canopy, well, but then, you know, these things have carbon-dated life that goes back 20,000 years. We've already blown that apart, haven't we? In order for flight to be sustained with power from the animal, the pteranodon must be able to deliver at least 68 watts of power. The maximum output power for birds today has been calculated at 98 watts. Assuming an 80% efficiency in converting muscular power to thrust, the pteranodon had a useful power output of 78 watts, compared with a minimum power for flight of 68 watts. Bramwell points out that this is barely sufficient, particularly because the 98 watts output power figure is the upper maximum limit for birds today. It would appear that the pteranodon must have had much more muscular tissue and a greater efficiency in converting muscular power to thrust than today's birds. The increased oxygen tension in the blood created with a larger partial pressure of O2 under the canopy could conceivably have contributed to the animal's ability to deliver thrust and continue flight without a too rapid buildup of oxygen debt. Under the canopy, the coefficient of drag would also increase. This has a direct bearing on the velocity of sink. Now, I'm very concerned about the velocity of sink. What am I getting a plane? In conclusion, a note on the extinction of the pteranodon is appropriate. This gigantic creature was primarily a soaring reptile. It probably used powered flight only rarely and when necessary. Due to the aerodynamics of the wing sections, there is an upper and lower limit to the wind velocities under which a 16.6 kgf pteranodon could sustain flight. The lower limit appears to be around 16.4 miles per hour. The upper limit around 31 miles per hour. Above 31 miles per hour, the sink velocity is so high and the lift coefficient so low that the animal could not maintain any kind of controlled flight. This raises some interesting speculations of how its extension may have been related to the vapor canopy. We assume that when Noah, if you believe the Bible, took two of every kind in the ark, pteranodons were among the animals preserved. Yet for some reason they were not able to survive the post-flood environment and quickly became extinct. Bramwell's comments are worth quoting in full. If a specific reason for the extinction of the pteranodon is sought, then a change in climate could easily account for it. Pteranodon with gliding speeds between 16 and 31 miles per hour was superbly adapted to light wind soaring. If the average wind speed had risen by only 5 meters per second, this alone would make the pteranodon's mode of life impossible. Such a change in wind speed could be brought about by a cooling of the climate, giving greater differentiation of temperature between poles and equator, leading to faster overall wind speeds. The birds survived the Cretaceous extinction. It could be significant that they are faster flyers than pteranodon and would have been able to deal with stronger winds. You got all that. Giants. The large size of the animals, giants that are referred to before the flood, and the large size of fossilized giant animals. Can I go a little further? Raises the theoretical question of how they were able to supply oxygen to their tissue mass. This question is also relevant to the gigantic insects and shells which used to live on the earth as well as vertebrates. Insects, arachnids, and other invertebrates take in oxygen through the skin by diffusion. This raises the question of how large such an animal could become before it could not acquire sufficient oxygen to maintain its metabolism. Further, if oxygen can make its way in only by diffusion from the surface, the bigger an animal, the lower, under given conditions, will be the concentration of oxygen at its center. It is obvious that there must be some size at which the concentration becomes too low for activity that the animal cannot exceed this size. Thus, some invertebrates can only exist or can exist only at certain size limits in order for the oxygen from the atmosphere to diffuse the center in sufficient concentration to sustain metabolic processes. Why are insects with 25-inch wingspans no longer found? Well, I don't know, but I'm glad. Why are the giant shell creatures, spiders, and other invertebrates not in existence today? I'm glad about that, too. If these animals once lived in an atmosphere where the partial pressure of oxygen was greater than today, listen to that. That's the whole nubbin of it. If these giant animals, insects, and vertebrates who absorb this oxygen by diffusion, if these animals once lived in an atmosphere where the partial pressure of oxygen was greater than today, they would have been able to exist at larger sizes. So for both the giant lizard and the invertebrate, the theoretical consideration exists. The reason they no longer exist in these large sizes is because the partial pressure of oxygen in our atmosphere has dropped with the removal of the canopy. If the Earth had been surrounded by a vapor canopy, the atmospheric pressure, and that's his theory, if it had been a water or an ice canopy, it might be more. A vapor canopy, the atmospheric pressure would have been 2.18 atm, assuming 40 feet of precipitable water in the canopy. And partial pressure of oxygen would have been 348.73 mm of Hg instead of today's value of 159.97, literally 2.5 times as much. An increase in the partial pressure of oxygen does not increase the amount of oxygen carried by the hemoglobin in the blood of vertebrates, but it does increase the oxygen tension in the plasma. Presently, the oxygen tension in man in the alveolar sacs is about 100 mm of Hg. By the time it passes through the capillaries, it's reduced to about 45 millimeters of Hg. Since the oxygen tension in the interstitial fluids, body fluids between the capillaries and the cells, is only 40 mm of Hg, there is a net diffusion driving force of at least 5 mm of Hg of oxygen, forcing oxygen into the cells of the body through the interstitial fluids. All of that says you get more oxygen. Could it be that due to the greater oxygen requirements of the large vertebrates, they required more oxygen than the present diffusion driving force could supply? If the oxygen tension in the alveolar sacs was doubled due to increased atmospheric pressure, this would increase the oxygen diffusion force. It's probably not a linear increase, and hence enable the animal to deliver more oxygen to its biomass effectively. So the great size of some animals in the past may be linked to this increased cardiovascular efficiency. The ratio between lung capacity and body mass would seem to be too small to support such creatures as dinosaurs. This ratio would be even more improbable if the recent speculations about dinosaurs being warm-blooded are true. Warm-blooded animals require immensely greater quantities of oxygen to maintain their greatly increased metabolic rate. The lung capacity necessary to fully oxygenate a 2-ton warm-blooded animal cannot be found in the fossils of dinosaurs that once roamed the earth. But if the canopy was there, it was possible. Presumably, Noah would have taken newly born dinosaurs on the ark. I don't think he'd take it a big one. As they entered the post-flood environment and grew, they were unable to survive in a climate of reduced oxygen partial pressure, and they actually suffocated. There is evidence that higher oxygen tension can be decidedly beneficial to biological systems. When a team of aquanauts were submerged in a diving bell for 2 weeks at 10 atmospheres, a striking healing occurred after one of them severely cut his hand. It was reported that the wound healed completely in 24 hours. It was theorized that the reason for this was that the higher oxygen tension created a greater diffusion driving force and imparted more oxygen at a greater rate into the wound. As a result, experiments in high-pressure surgery were begun. And hyperbaric surgery is now a common practice in certain situations. Also, it has been discovered that an effective treatment for some kinds of gangrene is to place the patient in a high-pressure chamber for a period of time. Thus, it would seem that a higher atmospheric pressure could have resulted in conditions that were favorable for the cure of some illnesses, and hence could have some bearing on longevity of life as indicated in Genesis 5. At the HBO Hyperbaric Oxygen Center in Lauderdale by the Sea, Florida, Claude Kirk has been administering hyperbaric oxygen treatments for many years with startling results. Patients treated for short periods at 2.5 ATM of pure oxygen and gradually decompressed show remarkable relief from the effects of aging. Let's all go there right now. I think I've made the point, as I want to do, because I teach with the Gestalt theory, that, you know, let's just wait a minute. This preacher isn't telling anybody they have to be a Christian. I'm not even telling anybody they have to believe the Bible. But I don't like the suggestion that if you believe the Bible and you are a Christian and you believe in these great cataclysms, that there's something inferior about your mentality. There has been a cosmos, a world perceptual set in favor of naturalism and the harmonious, unchanging development of the earth through an evolutionary process that puts the demand on Christianity that they uncork their brains and meet the challenge by saying, wait a minute. The Bible is not ipso facto wrong because it doesn't gel with this dominant theory that is exactly that, a theory. Now, I don't care if you believe in evolution. I want to believe in it because if there's a missing link, I can explain the TV evangelists. But the gestalt of what I'm saying is the Bible keeps coming through. Keeps coming through. Now, there are simpler ways to pursue this canopy theory. The worship of the serpent, for example, in the Eastern world can be collated to the way the precession of the sun, if it was an icy canopy, or a vapor canopy, would go across the heavens. That's another subject. This is the most scientific study I've seen on the subject. The interesting study of the subject is to collate the myths and legends, as Velikovsky has with the catastrophes of mankind, to collate the legends with the perceptual view of the world you would have under the canopy. I hope if I haven't done anything else, I've suggested to you, you don't have to park your brain to be a Christian or to be a biblical student. If you're still awake and glad that I pursued this to that point, get on a telephone and tell me. Otherwise, I won't do anything like this ever again. Did I put you to sleep or did you learn anything tonight? Get on the telephone. And those of you that are awake and that I have taught, I'd like a little cryptic response from you.